This is CliffCentral.com.
All right, I'm very excited to have Karen Morn here. She's an award-winning journalist, began her career working, believe it or not, in a mortuary. I mean, that's bloody exciting, if nothing else.
Well,
what a
I
place
have to technically,
start.
I mean, it was, my first job was the Rosmead Avenue Quick Spa. Let's not do fake news right here, people.
Yeah, we don't do fake. The what Quick Spa?
Rosmead Avenue in Kenilworth.
It's an institution in the area, actually.
Did you work at the till?
I wore what is described as a gobbler because it makes you look like a turkey, that green thing.
What's
and
that?
And I worked on the weekends, ne?
And what's the gobbler?
It's you know that little green thing that you put over yourself, and it's got these like weird little arm things that like make it's a reference to a turkey, Gareth.
Like, but is this gobbler. Like a Halloween store or a quick spa? It sounds pretty
no,
bizarre
it's a
to me.
Quick spa.
It's like a dress up joint.
And it was sure, back in the days before
now.
You all scan stuff. I had to type that stuff in manually.
No, you're allowed to hear. You're allowed to
I'm pretty sure it's a super spa now.
Yeah, it is a
it
super spa. You know, corporate SA has taken over. But yeah, that was my first job. But after that, the mortuary, yes.
But you've just started a new job.
Well, technically, I've sort of started not having a job. I'm on retainer to Tiso Black Star, so I'm not in an office.
But
so,
you can do what you like now.
Which is amazing.
Yeah, and you've earned this place.
I really, like, it's... I think at the beginning it's quite weird if you've been in that office your whole life and you're kind of looking in. But then once you get into it, you actually end up just actually having so much more fun. And I think having control over your space and where you put your effort is incredible. It's a great place to be.
Well, I want to talk about that and the career so far and all of that stuff. But I just have to remark on you seeing Justice for the first time in a long time. You had like a mini reunion out here. And you couldn't believe how early Justice gets
here. I was amazed.
Yeah.
It's not, I mean, that's real love.
Don't
Gareth.
Worry. We're amazed every time he comes because sometimes he doesn't. And then yeah. We get a call at like 8 o'clock. Guys, I overslept. But he did come in 2 weeks ago. I don't know what happened or why we deserve this, but Justice came in with a big box of booze. He
wow.
gave Ben a liter of gin. He gave Sia a bottle of what?
I got some vodka.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Gave Mabale some whiskey. I mean, we all got something.
He just randomly arrived
just
with alcohol.
With gifts and alcohol so early in the morning. Can you imagine?
But you understand if you cover South politics in South Africa, such things are necessary in your lifetime, you know?
Essential.
But we just roll with the booze in the back of the car at all times because you never know.
Never know when you
you're
need that booze.
You're going to be wanting to take a slug,
you know,
at some
in,
point.
In your career at ENCA, I remember we often would check in with you when you had a moment breathing room between chasing after the Guptas at the Saxonwold compound or going from court case to court case or the Oscar Pistorius trial, which you were front and center in. I mean, there just wasn't a dull moment. Did you ever feel like this is just too much? I got to get out of this. It's killing me because you don't get sleep. You're always on standby. Your phone could go off at any time. You, of course, as a journalist, had your own sources. You had your own people who you'd communicate with directly or indirectly. So you could be notified at 3 a.m. about something. When the hell did you sleep? When could you relax?
I think that if you I think it's a particular kind of person that is a journalist.
A bit crazy.
Yes, they are. Like you I say to like people who want to go into journalism, I'm like, first of all, are you nuts? Because like I'm being serious. Because if you are like a news junkie, finding things out, breaking news, knowing what the hell is going on and then telling people is like breathing for you. You can't not do it. I would never be able to fit in a corporate environment. I couldn't have an inspirational poster of a dolphin on my little cubicle and check Facebook every 5 minutes to, you know, circumvent the existential void that I was currently facing myself in. I have to do this job. I can't not be going out there speaking to people. I mean, I love it. Like, it's like breathing to me. So I think if that's your thing, yes, it's hectic. Yes, you know, you drive your family mad because it's Sunday lunch and you're with the parents and trying to have a roast leg of lamb. And you're like, oh, my God, this just broke it.
So,
I've just got to get you, you know?
Like when something like that happens, I just need to know how your thought process works. Because most of us, when we get news, it's always third, fourth, fifth in line. And most of us are not connected like you are to the actual story. So when you hear a bit of information that is potentially earth-shattering, you know, this one's resigned, that one's been locked up, this one's died, whatever it might be, who is the first person you need to tell? And what is the process that you go through, whether you're working for an ENCA or whether you're doing your own freelance stuff, or if you're just off that week and maybe you're not actually filing any stories?
You're never like, off.
You're never off.
You're never
but,
off.
But how does the process work? Like, what do you do first?
Well, there's a particular horror involved in corporate South Africa called the WhatsApp group.
Yes.
And ENCA had one, and now I'm on another one at TISA Blackstar. Basically, what will happen is what someone will call you, someone will send you a message. My thing is primarily court documents. So when I'm getting information, I'm getting an affidavit that's been filed, an order that's been granted. It's a court record. It's from a lawyer. It's from someone very reputable. So in that circumstance, I just start reading like a mad thing, pick up pivotal points, say, guys, this is my story.
Some of these documents can be long and tedious and boring and filled with legalese. It's not always fun to do that, but you have to go through that to make sure that you're dealing with something that's real.
And you have to, the most important thing is just to make sure you understand what's happening. Because the thing is with a lot of stuff, people, you have to clarify things in a way that's meaningful. So you're saying to people, this is what this means, this is what it means for you, this is what it means for South Africa, who cares what's going to happen now. Mm. And that's why it's very important to read as much as possible to really know your story. And, you know, in circumstances where someone's phoning you and saying, I've heard this and this and this, then obviously that's a very different process. You phone multiple people, you see who can go on record with you to confirm it. So you can say, Hawks spokesperson, NPA, whoever. And then you can attribute it. But it's just, I think the more you are in journalism, the more you realize that it's very important to absolutely establish and rather be right than first. I mean, I try and be first as much as possible, but I always go for right.
I mean, the sweetest thing is to be both.
Exactly.
And then you just feel like you're,
then you're like,
you know, top of the world.
It's like a drag, yeah.
For you, that's the
that's
real thrill.
Fave,
that's what you're chasing.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, I mean, you don't always get that. And it can be very frustrating because you might get very bad sources.
Mm.
And you spend a lot of time then checking up on them. Or you might get the news third or fourth and you're like, God damn it.
Yeah, but I mean, listen, in the landscape of news, South Africa is an all-you-can-eat buffet. I mean, there's never... You know, everyone's chasing different stories. And what's amazing is we have such exceptional journalists in this country. You know, C.D. Madea, Aldrin St. Pierre. We have Polly van Wyk, Sam Saul, Craig McCoon. We have brilliant, brilliant people. And, you know, I think we're in an environment now, particularly after the Gupta leaks, where there's just this mutual respect, you know. And so I have no issue with saying, for instance, if Polly does a great story on Tom Moyane and all his shenanigans and stars, saying this is brilliant journalism, like you need to read this. You know, she's on top of the story. So we used to have when I first started in journalism, because we were outside of the Twitter space, it was the Star, it was newspapers, we didn't have social media. There was this weird kind of competition with who was going to scoop who. And there is to a certain degree still that. But now with the Gupta leaks, with the weight of information out there, there's this realization we can't get to everything. We need to work together and we need to highlight journalists who've done a really good job of breaking down a big story.
And isn't there some kind of solidarity too? Because often the media is portrayed as the enemy in general. And then those journalists who are at the forefront of it, you know, the journalists who ask uncomfortable questions of ministers and so on, that they are labeled as the enemy because the opposition in this country is not as big a threat to the politicians who are in control as the media are. And as an investigative journalist is, because those are the people who've effectively exposed all this state capture and this corruption. I mean, if we owe anyone a vote of thanks in this country, it's intrepid journalists who've gone out and fearlessly reported on stuff which could have got them locked up. Many journalists have had assaults. Many journalists have been secreted away to places and treated very badly, tortured, beaten, banished. All kinds of horrible things have happened to people. And yet those stories have come to light because of the brave exposure by these journalists. They're obviously the targets of politicians who are doing nefarious things. Maybe that solidarity has brought journalism together as well.
Yeah, and I also think you have to give massive credit to the whistleblowers. I mean, that person who went onto the Gupta server and downloaded those emails. I mean, that kind of courage is insane. And, you know, whether it was Trillion or McKinsey or Eskom, there were all these, you know, a number of specifically black women who, like, lost their jobs. I mean, when you see what happened to people, I mean, Thuli Manansela has spoken about it, the kind of way in which whistleblowers are crushed. particularly when they speak out in big corporates about malfeasance and things like that. And those people really deserve massive levels of credit because they existentially experience the full weight of a corporate turning on them or a government department turning on them. And, you know, the consequences on a human level are often, like, deeply devastating for them.
Yeah, it's mostly much better to play it safe. You've sometimes got a cushy job, or maybe not even cushy, but it's security of a kind. And then you're expected to do something which will inevitably cost you your job, possibly your livelihood, and certainly end up putting you in the way of danger. For someone to decide to do that is crazy, and it's also true for journalists. I mean, why'd you take on a job where you have to deal with really dangerous criminals some of the time? I mean, you've met some horrible people who are currently in jail, some people who should be in jail. They have your number. You almost want to stay away from those stories if you're an ordinary citizen. You don't want to be close to those people. You don't want a gangsters having your number.
Ugh, you know what? The gangsters are usually very sweet, eh? It's so weird. I mean, like, really? When I started out, I was...
Is that because they see you as a resource to get things out there, or is
no,
it...
No, it's just, you know, I think it actually just never occurred to me to be scared. And I think that if you don't live in that mindset of fear, people don't engage with you. I don't know if I'm making sense.
Do they maybe have some respect for you that you're able
The lawyers will... You see, the thing is that what I try and do is just be as fair as possible, and I work off court documents. I work off stuff that's on paper. I don't write stories about sources and shadowy figures and
rumor.
You know, yeah, like, no. You know, I don't do that. And people appreciate that. And what's interesting is even with politicians, you know, you'll... Certain will not be happy with you when you go for them. But there are others that will understand, like, I'm here to do a job. You're here to do a job. We'll have a harsh question, harsh interviews. You can be polite, whatever. But after that, it's like, okay, cheers, see you next time. And they understand, like, you know, someone like Zizi Kodwa, for example, who's the ANC spokesperson, is brilliant at that. Zizi will know that you're going to come at him with everything that you have. And at the end of it, he'll come back at you and there'll be an interaction. And at the end, he gives you a hug and he goes home because they understand it's not personal. We're both trying to do our jobs here. Your job may be to spin. My job is to unspin. And so we're going to just respect each other in that space. So I've had some pretty hectic things happen. And I sometimes get like quite hurt, I think, when people say stuff on social media about I must be necklaced. And
yes.
And I'm just like, I just want to go and find that person and be like, hi, how you doing? Yeah, just be like, how was that your first port of call as a response to my tweet about Jacob Zuma? I mean, I don't know how necklacing and anyway. So you know that for me is a bit weird, but everything else is fine.
I'm very interested in your relationship with Bathabile Dlamini because the two of you were toe to toe so many times. There's some amazing videos that we have just pored over here, and it always seemed to me like you were trying very hard to be as polite as possible with her, but she did. This woman just was incapable of seeing that you were there to do that job you were talking about with Zizi Kodwa earlier. That you are not there as a fluff piece editor. That you're going to put together some beautiful profile like they did on Anela's show about her. That you were there to ask some questions about possibly the most important department in government, if you consider that 16 to 17 million people in South Africa rely on that department's execution of their duties for their very livelihood. Did it get to a point where was it early on that you could see that this was turning into something funny? Because she made it funny. It wasn't your doing. You weren't trying to create a comedy show, but my God, it was hilarious.
I mean, that press conference... That press conference started with the spokesperson basically telling us in this really hectic and aggressive way, you cannot ask questions about the DG. Cannot ask. And Zain Dangle had just resigned in the wake of the SASA crisis, and his resignation was a matter of public knowledge. They basically wanted to come there and have the minister, as she then was, read out a statement in which she really failed to address anything meaningful. I mean, she... And this is why she's now the subject of this inquiry into whether she's personally liable for the fees. Hmm. She created that crisis all by herself. But then you don't want to answer questions. And it was just... And then... You know, one of the other, Philip DeVette had sort of tried, Criselda Lewis from SABC had also tried. And then I don't know why she answered me when I asked her about the CEO, Tokozani Magwakwa. And I was just trying to find out, you know, what's your attitude? What's happened? You know, have you had a falling out? And for some reason.
That hit the nerve.
And then once it started. Because she was then locked into a kind of pride issue, and it just unraveled from there.
And then you had another altercation with her in like this a passage of a stadium or something. She was going to address a bunch of people, and you again.
I think there was
like pushing around and stuff.
Yes, and it was like, stop harassing me, and I'm like, ma'am, Just want some answers.
Do you think she, when she now does anything, and she's still around, she's ANC Women's League spokesperson.
She's a minister for women, which absolutely. Is something that obviously I feel somewhat conflicted about. This is my person in government, but anyway.
Yeah, well, the fact that you have to have a ministry is...
I know, it's problematic.
And it's so patronizing that it's lumped together with children and the disabled, as if the disabled don't deserve their own ministry, or... as if children and the disabled and women are all the same. They're all people who need help, you know.
No, Butabile
is the person who's going
to
help.
President Cyril Ramaphosa has made it very clear that he wants to kind of scour down,
yeah.
You know. And I think I sense just my offhand
that
reading.
Ministry may be dissolved.
Yeah, exactly.
But he
really
needed
is...
her. She's the head of the Women's League.
Yeah, and it was a political choice because
she has constituencies.
The SASA, what happened with SASA is inexcusable.
Yeah. Well, we're still dealing with it.
Also the fact that she showed such absolute contempt for the highest court in this country, who had walked into the SASA crisis, managed to salvage some sense of, okay, well, this is how we're going to sort this out.
And forced her to do her job.
And then she doesn't go to the court and say, well, you know, we've got this problem with CPS. What do we do now? She doesn't advise the court who's put an order in place that you're about to defy. And there was all this stuff on record about how she stopped the acting CEO from actually going to court, that he was about to launch his application and say to the court, this is what's happening. And she was blocked. And I mean, with the CPS story, I still fully believe that the exact machinations that went on there have yet to be exposed. There was this amazing moment when the Chief Justice, Mokgweng, also one of my favorite human beings on the planet, was like, this just looks so completely incompetent. Can you please just explain to us, like, what happened here? And I don't think we have that explanation. I think that explanation is still going to come out. Because no one is that stupid. If you're going to be, like, that stupid, it's going to be for a reason. Because, I mean, that's almost like mediocrity that deserves a medal, you know?
It's willful ignorance.
Yeah,
there's no way someone could be that ignorant of the universe without malice aforethought. There has to be some kind of plan, and she's the stooge.
Exactly.
She's the patsy, you know?
So it doesn't actually rationally make sense that you would go to such lengths to create a crisis
well,
that affects
so
all these people.
There's so much money involved here. There's 17 million people in South Africa who are on social welfare. There's a huge amount of money. If you took just 1%, if you scraped off 1% of 1% of this, you could retire.
Absolutely.
And there must be people on the take, and obviously there's much investigation still to be done. We still don't know what's going on with cash paymaster services. We still don't know whether the post office can or can't help to distribute these grants. I mean, there were stories about how military vehicles were going to be taken into rural areas and distribute cash out of bags filled with money. I mean, it's the kind of thing that you'd expect in a tin pot banana republic in Central Asia.
You know, and I've been to, you know, especially in rural areas where they distribute grants, and it's exactly what you're saying. I mean, people, sometimes families of eight are dependent on one grant. I mean, our poverty statistics are terrifying. 54% of the population living on 17 rand a day. The grant is lifeblood. So when you have anything that threatens that, it's literally an act of treason.
Well, it's also in it's particularly morally objectionable in a country and in a political party which tries to present itself as being a champion of the poor and the lowest in society, the people who can't stand up for themselves. It seems to me so unconscionable that those are the people who you let down first and that you're prepared to throw under the bus for some nefarious reason.
It's you have like two sets of elites in South Africa. You have your kind of Gupta type situation, people who are politically connected, who take advantage of their political connection to secure massive lucrative and undeserved government contracts. And then you obviously have corporates like Steinhoff who are busy doing equally nefarious things allegedly under the guise of the Stellenbosch Mafia, etc. And what's so problematic in our society is that if you are seen as white, then you're aligned to white monopoly capital. And if you're black, then RET. And it's actually not. These are two elites who are victims of both of them, guys.
Yeah.
Like, it's not one or the other.
But you can report on Steinhoff and report on state capture. But let's not create a false equivalence between the two, because the one is public money and the other one is private money. And as much as we all hate what's happened with Steinhoff, if you were an investor in Steinhoff, you're very pissed off. But that's private money. And even if it was the PIC who put money in there, even if it was, you know, state sort of retirement funds that went into that, they did that on the basis of what they calculated to be a good risk. Now, in the public money situation, it's so much worse because that money is meant to be spent on infrastructure, on housing, on social grants, on education.
Health, yeah.
We don't want kids dying in pit toilets, and that's not Steinhoff's job. It's much, much worse when it's government, and we must never draw some kind of fake parallel between the two, as awful as these corporate robber barons are.
The difficulty is that our institutions have been hollowed out to such a degree that neither of those people necessarily will be brought to justice.
No.
There are massive forensic deficits in the state. We haven't seen any high-profile commercial prosecution in this country, maybe since Fidentia.
But hasn't Sean Abrahams not been able to bring a single trial to fruition in terms of getting some kind of result, sending someone to jail, getting some money back? Not one in his entire tenure as the head of the National Prosecution Authority. This is insanity.
But it's not just about the NPA. The NPA needs to act on the evidence that's brought to it.
Yeah.
And you know,
so you're saying the investigative units, the police.
I mean,
detectives.
I did a story for Financial Mail. I mean, look at PRASA. PRASA makes the arms deal, according to one investigator, look like a Sunday picnic. Now, PRASA provides rail services to the, you know, poorest of the poor.
Right.
They're a vital piece of infrastructure. We spent billions of rands on trains that were too tall.
Yes.
We spent, like,
we're constantly replacing ones that are burnt.
The Siangena security deals, which, you know, the unexplained payments, I think, of about 550 million rand to Roy Moodley, who, of course,
Who's the security guard employer of the president.
Yes, that guy.
Right.
And PRASA goes and gets a legal firm of attorneys, Vaxmans, and spends, I think, about in the region of 150 million rand to save 2.5 billion rand to do this in-depth forensic investigation. And for 2 years, nothing's happened with it. To the extent that PRASA is now going to court against the Hawks to force them to make a decision on the investigation, to finalize the investigation so that something can happen. And the Hawks are taking the technical point of, don't know if Popo Molefe was duly authorized to bring this application. So it's just like lawfare. But why is there nothing happening? If you see the evidence that is out there that's contained in these court documents about how...
Well, Lucky Montana's own testimony is damning.
Exactly. You go from a circumstance where Siangena is getting 2.5 million rand for one little train station at the World Club. Now we're putting in CCTV, yay. To a circumstance where you're getting paid 31.5 million rand per train station. They initially got a tender for about 62 million. They got tenders for 4 billion rand, yo. And no proper processes were followed. And, like, nothing has happened, guys.
A billion, do you need to do right now? How much money that
is? And then PRASA goes to court with its current... I mean, there's all dramas in PRASA. I could speak for days. They go to court, and Siangena's like, same as the Hawk. We don't know if you all were duly authorized to bring this affidavit in the first place. guys.
It's obfuscation.
No, it is. And I mean, this is the thing. If we had to, you know, I think South Africans are corruption fatigued. Mm. I think they're like, oh, hell no. Look, I just, you know.
As you say, though, there are these sort of polls that you're immediately assumed to be a supporter if you're black of, you know, ANC Gupta-linked corruption. If you're white, you're always assumed to be a supporter of white monopoly capital, whatever that is. And if you're white, you naturally vote DA. And if you're black, you naturally vote ANC. There seems to be absolutely no respect for the individual in all of this. There may be people who break all of those rules, but they don't fit the narrative of South Africa, which is the narrative that Bell Pottinger decided we should all adopt. And we're still carrying on with it, even though we've defeated Bell Pottinger. We're caught in this crap. And as a journalist, does that make it difficult for you to report on stories objectively in situations where you're perceived to be the story some of the time, or where you get yourself in the way of it by no fault of your own?
I think the thing is just don't take it personally. Like, if you're going to be fearful and you worry about people, what they're going to say about you, don't go into journalism. Don't have a life. Don't be on any form of public platform. People are going to just hate you, and that's okay. Like, I just, you know, I've just learned, my feeling is that someone who is happy and contented in their life is never going to resort to the kind of comments that someone will say against me, and like really like quite hateful, hurtful, angry stuff.
Personal, like vicious.
Yeah, no, very vicious. But like, that person must be deeply unhappy.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not someone who's in a good place with themselves. If you're a happy soul, are you going to go on Twitter and be like, you must burn in hell and with your white forefathers?
And do it to a stranger.
Do you know what I mean?
This, like, is not someone you know.
No, but it's so interesting because, I mean, you get a lot of kind of weird abuse. You also get amazing, amazing support. And I think I'm already, like, I'm so encouraged by my engagement, particularly with young black people, because they're not stupid. They know what's going on. And they're not, you know, there are factions, you know, we saw the Gupta bots, but they're, people are highly intelligent. They engage with their reality.
And they see through the crap.
They do.
But you'll
fixate on that one person who's giving you like some weird.
We all do.
You know, but the majority of people are not in that place. The majority of South Africans are amazing. They're thoughtful and they want something to be better for us and for the country. And that's what you have to focus on.
And we're not so polarized. I mean,
no,
social media is not the real world. And if you look at what trends on Twitter, for example, which is a cesspool, that's not the stuff that most South Africans are consumed by. Most people are just trying to make enough money to feed their families, to try and live as good a life as they can, to occasionally, you know, get a nice TV or occasionally be able to put on a nice pair of shoes. Most South Africans are looking for very simple things, and they're not obsessed with the politics, and they're not obsessed with the Guptas even. I don't think most South Africans could care less at this point. You say we're fatigued by this, but I think we're almost numb.
You know, the thing is for me is like, I've spent a lot of time in rural areas. I spend a lot of time, you know, especially with the Checkpoint documentary stuff, telling the stories of people who are, you know, through their poverty, like on the fringes of society. And so I go to rural areas, you know, in and out of Soshanguve, Alex, all over the place. And you know what? I've never, ever encountered hostility. I've never encountered aggression. People have been massively kind to me. I'm a type 1 diabetic. And one time I was in deep rural KZN and I started having a fit and we didn't have any like sugar and I was going to go into a coma. The community and the cameraman was talking in Zulu saying, oh, you know, this girl, she needs sugar, wah, wah, wah. The whole community, like,
girl.
You know, like, Umlungu. And then the whole community ran and got Coke. And, like, we're, like, sitting there and this lady was holding me and pouring Coke down my throat to make me, because I was going into a coma.
Yeah.
People have pushed my car out of ditches in Manguzi. People have, like, you know, I've been in rural in Mpumalanga and I'm speaking in broken isiXhosa because they speak Swati there, saying, please, can you help me find the grandmother of this young boy, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
People find, you know, Mankandla, like, we went to do a church, form a church service there and it's the poorest municipality in South Africa. People have nothing. And
where is that?
It's in Mpumalanga. Nkandla is in KZN.
This is Makandla.
Nkandla. That's Zuma's
But you're talking about a different place.
No, in Nkandla.
Oh, Nkandla is the poorest municipality.
Yes, it is.
God,
and it would
what
have cost
an
them,
irony, huh?
It would have cost them 162 million rand to electrify that area, but of course it went to other things, namely the fire pool. Anyway, besides the point.
They're the poorest municipality in South Africa.
Yeah, they were identified by Thabo Mbeki as like desperately in need of upliftment. They've now got an IFP mayor who is amazing. They've had clean audits for the last few years. He's a former security guard who basically studied through UNISA at this private school where he was and he came back and he like phones me occasionally, Karen, we got a KFC. And then he was like so proud. And now they have some kind of education. I think it's a tech actually there. But anyway, so I'm there in Nkandla. We're filming this church service at 6 o'clock in the morning. And it's, you know, people have come all over and we're sitting outside and the community comes and they give you like a tray of cookies and juice. And I see this all the time, how kind people are to me. And that's why when I know that is the soul of this country. And that's why I don't want to be anywhere else. I don't want to be doing anywhere else because the people that I've encountered have really humbled me as a white South African who does come from a place of privilege, and I know that. But just how absolutely kind people are in this country. And South Africans will always help you. They will always help you.
Yeah, they
will. This idea that we hate each other, I don't experience that. In my lived reality, I do not experience that. And I refuse to believe that that is who we are.
But you also get to see the worst because, I mean, you started crime reporting. What, you were the youngest person to be a high court reporter at some stage?
Yeah, I was.
Yeah. So you've seen the really dark underbelly of society as well because the cases that you often would report on were horrendous, like child abuse cases and people who've murdered people and families that have axe murdered each other and just the most horrible things. I mean, didn't it harden you really early on? And make you really tough and kind of a little bit mean?
No, I think the thing is that you know, for every really dark situation, there's this kind of what I've learned is most of the time there are very few evil people. They're just complete losers who get drunk and high and do some horrific things. And then you come to court. And that was always, I remember that stood with me because I was so young. I was in my early 20s. I was coming to court. This guy's like raped and murdered a little child. And I'm expecting this evil satanic figure. And he wanders in there. And I'm just like, oh, like total loser. Mm-hmm. Like, and that's, I remember the mother of one of these.
You imagine this arch Machiavellian criminal.
And it's almost, it would be easier if that were the case.
Yeah.
Because now your little girl is gone. She's been sexually violated. She's been killed. And this is the guy that did it. Like, I think in a way it would be easier if people who did evil things were just evil and nefarious. Mm. But most of the time, just really, really not. But also what I did and what I continue to do, and I think it's what kept me like very soft, was that I would go through the process with the families. And oftentimes in the court situation, people didn't, you know, they're coming from, sometimes don't even know what's going on. They're getting anxious because this is all this language that they don't understand. And then you sit there and you're like, okay, this is what's going to happen. And so you form bonds.
You almost help them to understand the story first and then pass it on to the public.
And it's so you going through this journey with people, you're like accompanying them on this thing that, and the saddest, of course, is that no criminal trial ever brings people peace. They think like they're going to have the sense of resolution. And there's always, it's interesting, like post-trial depression, where people are thinking like, oh, this person's going to go to jail for life and then I'm going to feel better and I'm going to feel like there's closure now.
Nothing.
And nothing. I mean, you still got to go every birthday knowing that she would have been 9 today or 10 today or 12 today.
I saw a poster yesterday and I thought, what on earth? It was The Citizen, I think. What on earth kind of a headline is that? June Steenkamp is not going to bother with Oscar anymore. Something like that. I just thought, what a strange headline. Like, clearly they're trying to find a story here. And I mean, it's been how many years? And I don't even know if anybody's aware of, like, which prison Oscar's in or anything else. You were so involved in that story. I remember it was like you were the one who told the whole country what was going on.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's now 5 years because Reva died in 2013.
I mean, you were in the, you saw the house after the murder. You were there in the court when it was all happening. You got to know the families on both sides. You were the one trying to explain to us all these complicated legal terms and things that most South Africans now use when it comes to cases that they have no application for. But we're all legal experts, thanks to you. I mean, what was that like being in the middle of it?
Sure, it was crazy. I mean, that I don't think we'll ever see anything like that trial. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't typically have sustained reporting of court cases.
Well, that's why I bring it up, because I know you've done lots of other stuff, but it was so.
No, there was nothing like it.
What's
I don't
the
think
word?
That
it's
we are.
Kind of seminal.
Yeah, I mean, obviously now there's Henry van Rydaar, and that's its own sense.
I want to talk about that in a second.
You know, that's.
But tell me about what it was like to be in the middle of that, because you were sometimes sitting right behind or right next to or talking to face to face the people at the center of this drama.
It was extraordinary, and I think I still kind of. Yeah, it's just that sense that, you know, it was just a tragic thing. It was just a horrible, horrible, tragic thing. And, you know, I mean, for her family, like Barry Steenkamp has gotten massive health issues. And I remember when the day, when the news came out, there's this footage of him sitting on the stoop at their house in PE. And he just has this look on his face, and it's like a bomb's gone off in his stomach, and he never lost that look. And then, of course, you know, like, you know, someone who was a sort of superstar on the brink of massive success, was on one of Time magazine's most influential people, and they just destroy their life. I mean, I think it was one of the comments June actually made was like, you know, there's this idea people have, and it's also in the Twitter space as well, that now people are like, yes, you know, he's going to jail, wah, 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 and like, let's celebrate. There's no celebration here. For her, if you're claiming that celebration on behalf of Reva's family, that's not how they feel. They're never going to get her back. She's not coming back. Hmm. And like, they're going to have to live with that for the rest of their life. She would have been 34 now, possibly married, having kids, doing whatever, living her life, you know, on the brink of a, you know. And you don't, you know, I think one of the things that I find so compelling about court reporting is it's about taking this terrible thing that has happened, this inexplicable, horrible, horrible thing, and you put people in a room and you try and come to some sense of why did this happen and how do we make sense of it. And, you know, I mean, there's this great quote from an American journalist, like, about how trials are not about truth. It's about choosing one story over another. And then the truth somehow gets lost. There's a lot of subtlety and nuance. And I think that was very true. I still feel like I haven't read anything where I read it and I thought, my God, this really actually captures the full extent of what happened here. And I actually don't know that it ever could, because that case was, let's be honest, so weird that it kind of just, you know, it's impossible to really fully articulate all its machinations.
I think it also had to do with the fact that we live in a country where women are predated upon, like, daily. And we people throw out these statistics about how it's, you know, every 4 seconds or whatever some woman is raped in South Africa, and you just think, Jesus, how's that even possible? I don't know whether there's some part of us that we almost used that because it was such a public international story as a way to kind of project the pain of so many women in South Africa onto something that probably wasn't comparable to the experience of most South African women. But it is a thing I think about often. And you think about how many nameless victims there are out there, and people who will never get the attention, whether it's from social workers, whether it's from NGOs, whether it's from the courts, that they probably deserve. I mean, you must see stuff also in the court reports, and you must have over the last few years, that just turns your stomach, and that goes unnoticed. The only people that ever hear about it are the people involved and the judge.
No, that's absolutely true. And I remember at one point at ENCA being told in a meeting by a male manager that I'd done a story about, I wanted to do a story about a young woman who disappeared, believed to have been killed by her boyfriend, and they'd been searching in the area and they'd found a body, but it was the body of another woman. And this boss of mine saying, well, why is this even a story? And I was just like, Jesus. Oh my God.
Wow.
I mean, like, and also we don't, what's interesting with court reporting now is that we don't do a lot of coverage of cases of that are not known. You have your kind of celebrity trial.
Yeah, the celebrity trial. But compare like the Karabo Mokoena thing, like which is as horrific, if not more horrific, because the body was burnt and then it was transported and there was lying after the fact. And it was very clearly a much more difficult case in many ways. But it'll never get that level of publicity. And that just proves that things are not going to be equal. We've got to kind of settle for that. But I think for people, this Van Breda trial, too, is just so horrific. It's so horrific. You know, someone being shot is a gruesome, ugly thing. You've seen it a lot. But hacking a family to death with an axe.
Jeez.
Someone in the family, which clearly is what, you know, they're getting close to finalizing now. That's just stuff that should be front page news every day. It doesn't get nearly the attention that the Oscar trial got.
That the level of rage that it takes to, I mean, that's very, I mean, first of all, it's like very spontaneous because you're going for a weapon that's immediately available to you. But it's also rage because, you know what, physically, you know, to do that to another person and to stab them, to like, I don't think it's something that we can grasp as human beings. But
To not stop.
And then to do it with multiple other people. You know, I mean, that for me is, you know, it's a perverse thing, but I almost have more, I mean, sometimes you have these cases where someone's, you know, at a bar with their friend and they get into a fight and they stab them once and they hit a carotid artery or aorta and it's just 2 minutes and the person, I have sympathy because that's spontaneous. You know, like you can understand. There is part of you that
drunken stupidity.
Or you hit someone once and they hit their head and they
Fall and they crack their skull.
But it's that thing of just repeatedly doing that to someone, and also having the lack of empathy to see this person is suffering, like they're in pain.
And it's a family.
And you know
member.
What the thing is that person. You know, the fascinating thing for me is that, you know, oftentimes when we see stories about crime and violent crime, it's always the after effects and it's the case of the state and it's very kind of very sanitized. So, you know, the deceased died when the accused, you know, stabbed them, you know, 47 times, you know, after an altercation. But that person was begging you for their life. Like, we know that, and when the people testify, they won't, you know, sometimes you'll get it, but most often not. They refuse to say, like, what this person was doing. Because if someone is killing you, you know, I mean, even Karaba, can you imagine what she was saying? Like, please don't do this. Like, can you imagine someone is begging you to not take their life, and you just keep doing it? I mean, Karaba's case is, what I find so compelling about her is that, she documented her own existence in like a really meaningful way. And there we did two checkpoint episodes on it. And the one was actually one of the highest, it was the highest rated, the one on Sandile Mansoe was the highest rated one on news episode on DSTV in September last year. And it shows that people do care. This idea that people are not interested in court stories is nonsense. People want to watch this. They want to understand. But I mean, Karabo, like, you know, she in the last weeks of her life was documenting her abuse in a very meaningful way. And it was like she was leaving behind all the evidence of what was actually happening to her, that she was sort of saying, you know, this is my story. And there was, I remember in the Lee Matthews case, Sais van Sail, with that great quote about, you know, the dead looking on and whispering us, and like the dead do not die, they look on and whisper, and they're trying to tell us, like, through, and he was arguing at that point that Lee Matthews' body was telling the story of what had actually happened to her, And I feel like with Karabo, like, she always had this incredible sense of wanting to fight the cause for women. She was an active spokesperson against intimate femicide. She worked at women abuse shelters. She was determined to let what had happened to her in terms of the abuse that she'd suffered be a vehicle for good. And, you know, what's so incredible is, like, her sister, Bontle, saying that, you know, in her death, she started that whole, I mean, it, as controversial as it was, it started a conversation. Her death was what started the men are trash thing. Mm. The painful thing for me is, like, I live a life where I learn about people who are dead. And I tell the stories of these women, whether it, you know, whether it was Reva, whether it was Karabo, whether it was Marlene Quinnings. You know, you go after the fact and you reconstruct this life and this personality. And you just, like, especially with Karabo, I just thought, I would have really liked this girl, you know? Like, she was amazing. And I think that's the thing that I think is really, really important to the telling of meaningful stories about the justice system is don't just make this person like a victim who was killed. Turn this person into a human being who lived and whose life was taken away from them, because that's a different focus. We need to understand who we really lost here in order to really understand how horrific violent crime is.
Well, then it won't all be in vain.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's certainly not going to make it better for her family, and it still makes me so uncomfortable that someone had to have an end to her life that must have been so horrific. But at least if we learn something from it, there may be other people we can save, right?
I hope so. I mean, the woman abuse issue in South Africa is so horrifically prevalent that, you know, if month's end, if you go to any police station on the morning after people have been paid and there's a queue of women with bruises looking for protection orders. I've experienced it. And, you know, I had a student of mine at Rhodes who was murdered by her boyfriend. And, you know, I was a young reporter at the Argus then. And my boss just said to me, oh, there's some story about some student at Rhodes who's been murdered. And then seeing her name and realizing, sure, like, this is someone.
Someone you know.
I know.
There's another case that I just wanted to quickly touch on because it was just, again, so horrific. That Modimolle monster.
God.
I mean, Jesus, that guy was depraved.
And to this day, he still feels justified in what he did.
What I mean, did you ever get a chance to engage there?
I spoke to his daughter, and it was this most perverse thing because his name was Johan Kotze. She really, it was this classic victim blaming thing of, like, you know, Ina Bornet had treated her father in such a terrible way. And what typically happens with a lot of intimate femicides or attacks on women, obviously she survived, you know, being gang raped and tortured. Her son was murdered. You know, she's an amazing, amazing person, like very, very strong. But there's always this interesting thing with a lot of the defenses for intimate femicide or attacks on intimate partners and whatever. They always use this temporary non-pathological incapacity defense, temporary insanity. Oh, I don't know what happened. I was just so angry. And then the next thing, it does foggy. And then I see she's lying there covered in blood.
But that's,
they always
that's, but that's
say
bullshit.
That.
Bullshit. I mean, in her case, we know that this guy arranged the gang rape.
Yeah, and for 2 hours, guys, the whole time. And she's going, you know, he tried to say that, you know, he was pushed to this point and he was so overwhelmed and whatever. But it's a hallmark. It's a hallmark of, like, oh, I'm overwhelmed with our emotion. Our courts don't accept that defense. I mean, sometimes in tiny, rare, I mean, Vicky Momberg's trying to use the same non-pathological incapacity defense of, like, I'm not in control of what
I mean,
I
her
do.
Lawyers. She's, yeah. Not, she's not probably smart enough to.
Yes, that. Yes. But I mean, that, it's a typical thing, and the courts don't accept it because it was actually the road rage judgment. Do you remember that case in Cape Town with a guy that in Hart Bay where he was driving next to another guy and there was a whole incident and he got out the car and beat the guy to death with a hockey stick? And that was the and he argued temporary non-pathological incapacity, that this guy was driving so crazy and he was with this and he just lost it. And the court said anger's not an excuse for murder. Yeah. You get angry, yo, but you're still in control.
Handle yourself.
Handle yourself. And we're very angry. I think South Africans have deep post-traumatic stress disorder.
Well, we also have.
We're on the edge. All the time.
And men have a male role model problem because we don't have a lot of good fathers in society. And as a result, there's a cycle that is perpetuated generation after generation where the only way to behave is to behave badly in order to get attention. And the only love that you're going to get is through material success. And you know, there is no father-to-son love in many households. It's totally pathological. It's a problem. And it's not going to get better. And, of course, those men are the ones who take it out on women.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've got very fractured ideas of what defines relationships and what are acceptable. And it's damaging to all of us because, yeah, it's and also this idea of somehow being dependent on a male financially. I think a lot of women get put into pretty disparate circumstances and do a lot of things that are very damaging to themselves. Look at the rates of HIV/AIDS amongst teenage girls in this country because of the Blesser phenomenon.
That Blesser phenomenon, I was just about to say.
Exactly.
There's a social sickness.
You know, exactly. So they're compromising themselves and they're putting themselves in like horrific circumstances because they're financially dependent. And women stay in abusive relationships because they've got children and they're financially dependent. And that's, you know, it's not just about the violence. How do we get to this point where people will be kicking the shit out of you and you still stay? Mm. I mean, and that happens so much.
I think at the bottom of all of it, on both sides, is the self-worth issue.
Mm.
Like a feeling of, I'm not worth it and I deserve this in some way. It's like it's a deep insecurity complex mixed with the fact that you've been told that you're worthless and that you've been treated by society as worthless for a long time. And it just carries on. People don't know better because they don't think they deserve better.
But also that if you wreak violence on another human body, that you're
empowering yourself.
Yeah, because you also have deep self-worth issues.
Yeah.
Because
if
you're a joyful person who sees value in yourself, you won't ever be able to hurt someone like that.
No.
You can't. Like,
pains you.
You know, you wouldn't be able to wreak violence on a, you know.
Well, you've wreaked violence on all of us by leaving television. And I'm going to hold
you responsible. I'm on Checkpoint. Okay,
so you're still doing Checkpoint. But let's just talk about what you are doing now. Because this, I don't understand. I don't even know what Tiso Blackstar is. So let's start there.
No, Tiso Blackstar is like Sunday Times, The Wit, and
It's a media
business
house.
Day, Financial right. Mail.
And you are doing different projects for them.
Yeah, so I'm called a group contributor. So I don't ever go into the office. I just write stuff for them depending on where I am and what I'm doing. And I'm on a retainer with them. And then I also do stuff for Checkpoint. So I'm doing a documentary at the moment for Checkpoint. Do stuff for Al Jazeera, you know, usually on the former president.
Yeah.
And you just go and do stuff for SABC. I'm having a lot of fun because I can control my day and can control what I'm up to.
Did you like Fikile Mbalula's congratulations when you decided to resign from ENCA and he sent you a message of support? It was very illiterate, but he did try. I mean,
he means
well.
No, he's lovely. I mean,
he's been moved around a little bit lately. So
no, he understood. No, he's, you know, the irony is that people think I'm this combative person, but I get huge levels of like support and,
Why shouldn't you?
Yeah. And I was quite touched by that. You know, he's obviously hilarious.
You may not know this, but you are great at what you, I think he means do, Very thorough, serious depth, but hey, we all need to grow. Good luck for your future endeavors.
Yeah, I mean, if you're getting tweets like, no, it's very sweet. Thank you.
But live news reporting on television or on the internet, as it is these days, is the most fun. It's the most exciting. I mean, writing is great because you can actually digest. It can be more cogent. It can be well researched. You can corroborate evidence and sources and all that kind of thing. So it's much more thorough. But that TV stuff, I mean, you were good at it on the trot. I remember you outside that Saxonwold compound not so long ago, busy reporting as there were vehicles going in and vehicles coming out. And that's exciting, right?
It is super fun. And, I mean, ideally you should be, like, doing a lot of different projects. But I think the thing is that the only reason I would have stayed at ENCA was because I was afraid that I couldn't be anything beyond that.
Which is a terrible reason to stay.
Which is a terrible reason. If you're staying in something because you're fearful, you should probably just jump.
And it's good to quit while you're at the top.
Yeah.
Because that's when your power's at the best possible, you know, wavelength or amplitude point. And you can then decide from there whatever you want to do. And you're cashing in at the right time.
Yeah, I honestly believe it was the right decision for me. And like, I love my colleagues, you know, and I was in ENCA like last, I mean, I've been in and out there now because we're doing the checkpoint stuff, and I still occasionally go on and do analysis with them. And you know, the one thing I do miss is my colleagues, because it is really the most fun, loving newsroom I've ever worked in. And I mean, we're always very, very supportive.
Those are words never get used, loving newsroom.
No, we have a loving newsroom. the colleagues that I had there are amazing, and I'll always support them, and they still get a hold of me. Do you have a number? Can you know, I'll always help them.
Of course.
But I think it was just, I also felt like it was becoming a little bit too easy. Do you know what I mean? Like, you can do this in your sleep.
And you, everybody gets a bit institutionalized after a couple of years.
You know what I mean? Well, you would know, so.
Yeah, got out of there while I could.
Exactly.
But, how do you unwind? I mean, like, how do you actually let go of all of this very serious stuff? What do you do for fun?
I'm really bad at fun right now, mainly because I've got so much stuff. So I've been working quite flat out, and I'm trying to get myself into a place where I do relaxing type things.
Do yoga or something.
Yeah. I mean, I go to the gym.
Yeah. Okay. I do that. That's good.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, you've got to be fit to outrun the gangsters and the criminals.
No, the running, I've always said, if you're going to be a journalist, you must be able to run. Even in high shoes. It is a very important thing. That's why you see someone who's like chunky on a story, like, honey, this is not a good idea for you.
Because if things go wrong...
Yeah, exactly. I mean, my former colleagues, we have a few cameramen who are a bit on the chunky side, and I would be like, listen, guys, I hate to bring this up, but people are throwing rocks at your head. You got to thank me. I'm like, why are you so chubby? No. And I was trying to get one of them to go on a diet, and he seems to be listening to me, so I hope that works out, because I'm doing it out of love for his well-being.
You're not a fattest.
I'm not a fattest. You know, I just don't want you to die because you can't get away from the brick.
Alan Ford's giving you dirty looks. He thinks you're a fattest.
I'm not a fattest.
All right, Karen Morton, very nice to see you. I know we could talk about this stuff for a day and a half, but I appreciate you coming in so early to make some time to talk to us. I've been trying to get you into the studio for months.
Rubbish.
No, it's true.
No, Sia was the only one who called me, isn't it? Yes.
Well, Sia's the one.
And he's so cute. So like, hi, how are you?
Yeah.
Like, very charming.
Hey, take that compliment on my behalf. Thank you very much.
Karen Morn, everybody.
This is CliffCentral.com.